Join me in the book of Acts, chapter 22 this morning. I hope you brought your Bibles with you or can reach one. If you don't happen to have one with you and want to get up and go out in the foyer and get one out of the bookcase, you're welcome to do that as well. We're going to do a great deal of reading in the Scriptures this morning. We like to say we read the Scriptures all the time, but the truth is most of us preachers like to hear ourselves talk, and so we don't read as much as probably we ought to. We're going to make an exception to that this morning. We know that the Apostle Paul, when he wrote to Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verses 16 and 17, said that all Scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable, useful, to be used for teaching, instruction, correction. As Paul wrote that to Timothy, he primarily had in mind the Old Testament Scriptures. We're now convinced that those New Testament Scriptures that Paul had a part in writing also are included in that same teaching, that these were written under the guidance of God, and they are to be used for our instruction. Paul will write to the Roman Christians in Romans chapter 15, and about verse 4, again when he was quoting from the Old Testament, but he was writing to people who were primarily Gentiles and so didn't really have much of a background in knowing the Old Testament. But as he quotes the Old Testament to them, he tells them that whatever things were written before our time were written for our learning, so that we, through patience and the encouragement or comfort of the Scriptures, might have hope. We're at that point in our study of the life of the Apostle Paul where it's necessary for us to just read what Luke tells us is happening. Paul has gone to Jerusalem after being away mostly for 25 years. You know, he did part of his growing up in Jerusalem. He got his education in Jerusalem. He was a outstanding leader among the younger Jewish leaders. At the time, he was Jewish. He had even participated in and then became the leader in persecuting Christians, as we have recorded in Acts chapter 6, 7, and 9. But something happened on that road to Damascus in which he became convinced that he was totally wrong, and that the Christians that he had been persecuting and even killing were totally right. And he changed from being a devout Jew, that is, of the Jewish religion, and a persecutor of Christians, to being a outstanding spokesman for the things that Christians believed in. And spent the next 25 years of his life up until the point where we are now, traveling from place to place, Tarsus, Antioch, all sorts of little places we've never heard of except they're mentioned in the Scriptures. Ephesus, Philippi, Thessalonica, Athens, Corinth, preaching the gospel and leading others to faith in Jesus Christ and establishing churches. And now he's come back to Jerusalem to show respect, I think, for his Jewish heritage, but even more so to show respect for the church that existed in Jerusalem, the same church that he at one time had devoted his whole energy to destroying. And he's brought with him a number of other men from churches that he had helped establish and grow. And they've brought with them apparently a considerable sum of money to give to the church in Jerusalem because so many of the Christians in the church there were in poverty. And we've talked about that before. But now while he's here in Jerusalem, he inevitably is going to rub shoulders with and come into contact with many people who still remember what happened all those many years ago. Now, that doesn't seem to be much of a problem within the church in Jerusalem, but it's going to be a real problem with those Jewish people who were not Christians, who remember the time when he was one of them, but now, over all these last 25 years, has actually promoted the cause that they still stand against. These would be the religious leaders, the high priest and those around him, the Sanhedrin, the Jewish ruling council, the 72 men who make that up, and many others who were very devout, zealous Jewish people, but did not believe that Christianity was true. And now as he's back in Jerusalem, he delivers the money to the elders of the church. He reports to them of what great success the gospel has had among the Gentiles throughout the part of the Roman Empire he's traveled for the last 20-something years. And they ask him to set an example for the Jewish Christians by actually going to the temple with other Jewish Christians and still showing his respect for Jewish tradition. Certainly, if they had asked Paul to get up and say that people needed to keep the Jewish traditions in order to be saved and to be right with God, he would have been against that. But at the same time, he recognized that as a Christian, he and they had the right to still practice things that in and of themselves were right, as long as you did not insist that you had to do that to be pleasing to God. And of course, that would have meant things such as keeping a Sabbath day, circumcising your children, keeping vows and promises under the Jewish way of doing that, even going up to this temple that God had actually ordained to be built. Even though it was no longer the place where you had to worship God, you certainly could still worship God there. And so he participated with them in that. But this was as a holiday season for the Jewish people. It was at the time of Pentecost, and thousands and tens of thousands of Jewish people from all over the Roman Empire had come in there for celebrating this holiday. At the same time, Paul is there, including some people from some of the very places where he had preached the gospel and where he had been in sharp conflict with them, such as in Ephesus. He had been in Ephesus for 3 years preaching the gospel, and the Jewish community there, the part of it that didn't accept the gospel, had been strong opposers of Paul and sharp conflict with him in Ephesus. And while he's in the temple now in Jerusalem, some of those people who had first met him and opposed him in Ephesus are also up at the temple worshiping. And they see him over there, and they see an opportunity to do what they were not able to do in Ephesus. Since they could not successfully oppose what he taught, they resort to what many other people even today resort to, violence, to try to stop someone. If you can't answer what they say, then demean them, attack them, do everything you can to silence them by unethical means. And so these people from Ephesus, seeing Paul over there, start shouting out, "Here's a man who is defiling the temple." And they start telling everybody that he's brought Gentiles into the temple, which he had not done. And that he's desecrated this holy place, which he had not done. But it doesn't have to be true. You just have to get the crowd on your side. And no doubt at least some in the larger crowd recognize the name of this man, Paul or Saul of Tarsus. And they can remember way back whenever he at one time had been a devout Jew like them, and they had heard over the years that he had become an outstanding spokesman for Christianity, and that just never had set right with them. And so they join in this, and there's such a riot that actually begins that as they're dragging Paul out of the temple, those who are guardians of the temple, the temple police and so forth, push the crowd out and close the gates and doors behind them to keep them out of the inner part of the temple. It's clear that the purpose of these people from Ephesus and others who's now joined them, who know who Paul is, their intent and desire is what? To kill him. Right now. He's not going to have, if they have their way, there's not going to be a hearing, there's not going to be a trial, there's not going to be any opportunity to even examine whether the things they're shouting and accusing him of are true or not. They want to kill him, and they want to kill him now so they can be rid of him. That's how intense their hatred has become of him. And for what? Not because he desecrated the temple. Not because he was a robber or a thief or a murderer or anything like that. But simply because he preached the message about Jesus Christ. And they felt so threatened by that, and they had rejected that message, that now they want to kill him. But they didn't have the opportunity to do what they intended to do. Because the Romans, who controlled this part of the world, had long before built a fortress on the edge of the temple area. And had built towers up high enough where they could look down into the temple. And any time problems arose down in the temple area that they felt like threatened the peace of the city, they could immediately dispense soldiers down into there and solve the problem if at all possible. And that's what happens now. It becomes clear to the Romans up in the tower that there's a problem in the temple. They send a group of soldiers down, and they immediately push their way through the crowd, and of course they're armed and they're Romans, and you know, you don't want to mess with them. And they get to Paul and they grab him. They have to take him away from the crowd. Paul, by this time, I just have to imagine, has his clothes half torn off of him. He's probably bruised and bleeding and cut. And as I can only imagine what I might be something like at a time like that, totally confused and frightened, and your heart's racing 100,000 beats a minute or whatever, and the crowd is still shouting to kill him, and they're trying to demand of the Romans that they let them have him back so they can finish the job. And the commander of the Roman soldiers thinks that this fellow must be a really bad fellow for everybody wanting to kill him this way. And there had been a time only a couple of years before when a Jew from Egypt had actually come up to Judea and had raised up a large number of people to follow him, claimed to be the Messiah, this guy did, and had gotten quite a few people to follow him, and the Romans had finally come in and brutally put down the rebellion. Many were killed. The Egyptian himself had escaped, and they didn't know where he was. He was considered a terrorist by the Romans, and they were still looking for him. And we're going to meet in just a little bit in the scriptures here the governor of the Romans who oversaw this suppression of the Egyptian and his uprising. He was a governor by the name of Felix. Probably this Roman soldier commander was part of the Romans who had also participated in that. And so the Roman commander thinks, well, maybe this is that Egyptian we've been looking for. And so he's thinking, I think in his own mind, for a moment at least, that we finally caught this fellow we've been looking for so long. And the Jews, on the other hand, are thinking they're taking Paul away from us before we have the chance to finish the job we want to do on him. And so as they're taking him back into the fortress, they get up on the steps that led up over the wall into the fortress, and Paul collects himself enough to actually ask the commander in perfectly good Greek, "May I have the opportunity to speak to the crowd?" This totally catches the commander off guard. It actually says there at the end of chapter 21, he says, "Well, aren't you the Egyptian who started the revolt and led 4,000 terrorists out into the desert some time ago?" And Paul's response was, "No, I'm a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia." That's at the other end of the compass from where Egypt is. "A citizen of no ordinary city. Please let me speak to the people." The commander grants Paul permission. And so Paul apparently stands on the steps of the Antonia fortress facing this huge crowd that wants to kill him. And he sees in this an opportunity to try one more time to share with his fellow Jews the gospel. What happens over the next three chapters sort of plays out in five parts. First, he addresses the crowd. And the next day, then, he will stand before the Jewish court, the Sanhedrin. That evening, or maybe the next evening after that, he will be transported by the Romans from Jerusalem up to Caesarea for his own protection. And then shortly after that, about 5 days, I guess, after that, he will actually stand before the Roman governor himself and have a hearing. We'll see if we can read most of that this morning together, maybe with a minimal amount of comment on my part. Acts 22, actually 21:40 beginning. "Having received the commander's permission, Paul stood on the steps and motioned to the crowd. When they were all silent, he said to them in Aramaic, 'Brothers and fathers, listen now to my defense.' When they heard him speak to them in Aramaic, they became very quiet." Aramaic was the native language of Judea during this period of time. The commander understood Greek. He probably didn't understand Aramaic. So it's quite likely that most all of what Paul is going to say to this crowd, the commander has no clue what Paul actually is saying to them. And when Paul said, "Let me make my defense," he's saying, "Let me make my explanation of what this is about. Then Paul said, I am a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city. Under Gamaliel, I was thoroughly trained in the law of our fathers and was just as zealous for God as any of you are today. Now, Gamaliel was a highly respected teacher, probably dead by this time, almost surely. But the people knew who he was. He was a famous rabbi in their city. This makes it clear to the crowd that Paul is not who at least some of them may think he was. Others who already knew who he was, they already were familiar with these facts. I persecuted the followers of this way to their death, arresting both men and women and throwing them into prison, as also the high priest and all the council can testify. I even obtained letters from them to their brothers in Damascus and went there to bring these people as prisoners to Jerusalem to be punished. He began his address by saying, brothers and fathers. Fathers meant the leaders of the people. Some of the people who 25 years before had participated with him in persecuting the Christians are in the crowd listening. And so Paul actually tells the whole crowd, I was once like you. I opposed the Christian faith. And your leaders and my leaders participated with me in that, even giving me permission to go to other cities and try to find Christians and hunt them down. And so he says, I went there to bring these people as prisoners to Jerusalem to be punished. About noon, as I came near Damascus, suddenly a bright light from heaven flashed around me. I fell to the ground and heard a voice say to me, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? Undoubtedly, even most of the people in the crowd who knew who Paul was never understood why he had become a Christian. They're having the opportunity now to hear the story. Who are you, Lord? I asked. I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting, he replied. My companions saw the light, but they did not understand the voice of him who was speaking to me. What shall I do, Lord? I asked. Get up, the Lord said, and go into Damascus. There you will be told all that you have been assigned to do. My companions led me by the hand into Damascus, because the brilliance of the light had blinded me. A man named Ananias came to see me. He was a devout observer of the law and highly respected by all the Jews living there. He stood beside me and said, Brother Saul, receive your sight. And at that very moment, I was able to see him. Paul said, a miracle has occurred. Then he said, the God of our fathers has chosen you to know his will and to see the righteous one, and to hear words from his mouth. You will be his witness to all men of what you have seen and heard. Ananias explains to Paul not what had happened, but why it had happened. He said, you have had the opportunity to see Jesus. Now, these events are happening some 4 or 5 years after Jesus had been crucified, and as the Christians had been telling, risen from the dead and gone back into heaven. Up until this moment, Paul had been opposing all of that and arresting anybody who said that. Now suddenly he's seen Jesus, he's heard him speak to him, and he's even heard Jesus tell him that now you're going to be a spokesman for me, that I'm giving you an assignment. Ananias is making this all clear to Saul. And now, what are you waiting for? Get up, be baptized, and wash your sins away, calling on his name. This was one of the signature things that those early Christians did. They taught people that they needed to repent of their sins and be immersed or baptized to have their sins washed away. This was the mark of becoming a Christian, entering into this Christian community. Again, many in the crowd who are listening to Paul have observed for the last 25 years, if they've been around, the Christians among them doing this. And while there was sort of an uneasy peace by now between the Christians and the Jews in Jerusalem, probably most in the crowd never understood what the issues were and why Christians did what they did. Paul is brilliantly explaining many of these things to them. Then he says, when I returned to Jerusalem, that happened to be 3 years later after the things in the Damascus, but he doesn't mention that here. When I returned to Jerusalem and was praying at the temple, I fell into a trance and saw the Lord speaking. Quick, he said to me, leave Jerusalem immediately, because they will not accept your testimony about me. Paul is saying, over 20 years ago, the Lord told me that people in Jerusalem don't want to hear the gospel. This is sort of his backwards way, or backhanded way of saying, that's an explanation of what's happening right now. That for more than 20 years, many people in Jerusalem have not wanted to hear the message about Jesus. And that's really the issue that's here. It's not a matter of me desecrating the temple. It's not a matter of me bringing Gentiles into the temple. It's not a matter of me speaking against the Jewish religion all over the Roman Empire. That's not the issue. The issue is whether or not people want to hear the message about Jesus Christ or not. Lord, I replied, these men know that I went from one synagogue to another to imprison and beat those who believe in you. And when the blood of your martyr Stephen was shed, I stood there giving my approval and guarding the clothes of those who were killing him. Then the Lord said to me, go. Jesus has to tell him twice. Go. I will send you far away to the Gentiles. The crowd listened to Paul until he said this. Then they raised their voices and shouted, rid the earth of him. He's not fit to live. And as they were shouting and throwing off their cloaks and flinging dust into the air, the commander ordered Paul to be taken into the barracks. Again, I suggest to you that the commander doesn't actually know what Paul said, because he's speaking a language the commander doesn't know. But he can tell by the response of the crowd suddenly to what Paul's been saying that they really want him dead. So surely this must be a really bad person. He's already eliminated the idea that he's that Egyptian, but he must be some other kind of bad person. And so he directed that he be flogged. This was a form of beating, of an official Roman form of punishment, sometimes done with whips, most often, when they use the word flogging, done with a rod. And they would usually take a person and do one of either two things, either tie them with their back bent over to a low post in the middle of a courtyard and tie their hands to it, so their back was exposed, or even more brutally, sometimes actually string them up, tying them by their wrist and hanging them from the ground. And what was the purpose of this? That he be flogged and questioned in order to find out why the people were shouting at him like this. Over all the centuries, it seems like most people have thought, well, if someone has done something bad, the best way to get the truth out of them is to beat them until they tell us the truth. You know the sad story about that? If you hurt someone bad enough, they'll tell you whatever you want them to say to make you stop. That's not necessarily the way to get to the truth, is it? But that's what they're proposing to do with Paul, and that was a normal Roman way of doing things, and it's still, unfortunately, a common way of doing things in our world today. And as they stretched him out to flog him, Paul said to the centurion standing there, is it legal for you to flog a Roman citizen who hasn't even been found guilty? The truth is that sometimes the Romans literally killed people trying to get the truth out of them. Paul knows that. So he takes advantage of something he seldom has taken advantage of. That is the fact that he is actually a Roman citizen. The majority of people living in the Roman Empire were not citizens. They did not have the special rights and privileges that came with having Roman citizenship. They were residents of the empire, but not citizens. Roman citizens had been guaranteed for hundreds of years certain inalienable rights, as we refer to them today, including the right not to be punished before there was a trial and a guilty verdict rendered, the right not to be flogged, which would be a form of punishment as if you were guilty. And so Paul takes advantage of his right at this moment. When the centurion heard this, he went to the commander and reported it. What are you going to do? He asked. This man is a Roman citizen. Technically, the Roman commander was obligated, if he had any reason at all to believe that someone in his care was a Roman citizen, he was supposed to question them directly about that to ascertain their status before he did anything to them. And yet he's given the command to have this man flogged without checking. The man had earlier told him he was from Tarsus of Cilicia, which at least left open the possibility he had a Roman citizenship. But he hadn't asked that. He's now himself broken Roman law. We're going to see from this point forward, the commander is going to be very conciliatory towards Paul, in hopes, I think, that Paul not press charges against him. The commander went to Paul and asked, "Tell me, are you a Roman citizen?" "Yes, I am," he answered. Under Roman law, if you claim to be a Roman citizen and did not have the evidence to prove that, should you be asked for that evidence, you could be immediately put to death. That's how valuable Roman citizenship was. If you claimed to have it when you didn't, you could be executed for that one crime alone. Apparently, Paul had the evidence with him to prove that. Then the commander said, "I had to pay a big price for my citizenship." There were only a few ways to get Roman citizenship. You could have been born into a family that already had Roman citizenship, and so it passed on to you. You could have done something so valuable to the Roman Empire that the government would grant you citizenship in return for this service you've rendered to them. Or, if you could find a corrupt official in the right position, you could pay enough money, a bribe, and they would make sure the paperwork got filled out as if you had done something valuable to the empire, and you would get citizenship. We hear this man confessing that's how he got his. "I had to pay a big price for my citizenship, but I was born a citizen," Paul replied. And those who were about to question him withdrew immediately. The commander himself was alarmed when he realized that he had put Paul, a Roman citizen, in chains. Now, that changes Paul's relationship to the commander and to the Romans at the present time, but it doesn't solve the bigger problem of what he's going to do, the commander that is, with Paul and the Jews. The next day, since the commander wanted to find out exactly why Paul was being accused by the Jews, he released him and ordered the chief priest and all the Sanhedrin to assemble. Then he brought Paul and had him stand before them. So Paul is going to actually have a kind of trial before the Jewish Sanhedrin. The commander is there to try to ascertain by what goes on in this hearing exactly what Paul is guilty of. Paul looked straight at the Sanhedrin and said, "My brothers, I have fulfilled my duty to God in all good conscience to this day." Remember, many of these men were probably there the previous day when Paul had spoken to the crowd. So he didn't seem to feel obligated to tell them all over again who he was, where he was from, and how he came to be a Christian. They already all knew that. He tells them now that he has always acted in good conscience, that he's done this out of a sincere belief that what he's doing is right. At this, the high priest Ananias ordered those standing near Paul to strike him on the mouth. That was against Jewish law. History tells us that Ananias, who was high priest at this time, was considered one of the most ruthless, unethical high priests the Jews had ever had. That's who's in charge right now. He seems to have very little respect for the law except when it suits him. And a person being charged of something and brought before the Jewish court had the right to speak for themselves. This man orders that Paul be slapped across the face to shut him up. It's almost as if the high priest is saying, "I'm in charge here. You shut up." Then Paul said to him, "God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. You sit there to judge me according to the law, yet you yourself violate the law by commanding that I be struck." Maybe we see a little bit of fire in Paul right here, a little bit of anger. Righteous, right, but still. But we might remember that a few years before, 25 or 30 years before, another person had stood before the Sanhedrin and they had had him smitten as he stood before them. And Jesus had said at that time, "What crime did I commit?" Jesus also asserted his right, this time as a Jewish person, to not be treated that way, because the law forbade that. And yet that's how they treated him too. Those who were standing near Paul said, "You dare to insult God's high priest?" And Paul replied, "Brothers, I did not realize that he was the high priest. For it is written, 'Do not speak evil about the ruler of your people.'" Then Paul, knowing that some of them were Sadducees and the others Pharisees, called out to the Sanhedrin, "My brothers, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. I stand on trial because of my hope in the resurrection of the dead." That's expected that probably they were going to bring in and say, somebody's going to say that we found this man in the temple and he was desecrating the temple because he brought Gentiles in there with him and all of these sort of things. That's how the trial was probably laid out to go. But Paul knows that's not the real issue. So he wants to go ahead and get the real issue out on the table. He wants to do that not only so the Sanhedrin itself can acknowledge that's the problem, but so the Roman commander can see this is the problem. And when he said this, a dispute broke out between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. Over half of the Sanhedrin was made up of the Pharisee party. That was a party who believed in the possibility of resurrection one day. They believed in angels, and they believed in life after death. The Sadducees, which made up mostly the high priest family and the party that was a part of them, did not believe in miracles, angels, life after death, or resurrection. So when Paul brings this up, and he says the fundamental issue is, I believe in the resurrection. Of course, what is he talking about? I believe somebody was raised from the dead, named Jesus. Immediately, the assembly itself is thrown into confusion. And it says here, the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection and that there are neither angels nor spirits, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. There was a great uproar, and some of the teachers of the law who were Pharisees stood up and argued vigorously. Suddenly, there's people on Paul's side. Not because they believe in the gospel, and not even because they care anything for him, but because they are devout believers in this idea that God does sometimes speak to people and that there might be a resurrection one day. Now remember, Paul claimed that someone spoke to him on the road to Damascus, and later somebody spoke to him in the temple. And so now some of them are saying, "We find nothing wrong with this man," they said. "What if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him?" Suddenly they're willing to entertain the idea that Paul, whether they believe what he says or not, might have at least had God speak to him in some way. The dispute became so violent. Remember how occasionally on television we see in some foreign government how the members of their House of Representatives or whatever will get so agitated with each other they'll have fist fights in the aisles? They used to do that in the United States too. I wouldn't put it past it to happen again someday, but that's what's happening here. Suddenly, these most august leaders of the Jewish people, these men dressed in robes and referred to as father by everybody else, are having fights with each other in the middle of this hearing. The dispute became so violent that the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them. He ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him back into the barracks. The following night, the Lord stood near Paul and said, "Take courage. As you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome." The rest of this chapter tells us that a nephew of Paul's hears of a plot that's going on among the Jews, that the Jews are going to ask the commander to bring Paul back once more to stand before the Sanhedrin, and this group of 40 people have put themselves under a vow that they will make sure that Paul's assassinated before he ever gets there. And a nephew of Paul somehow hears this plot. Some have suggested, there's been even a movie made in which this was the way it turned out, that actually Paul's sister's husband was a member of the Sanhedrin. That's in the movie, understand. That Paul's sister's husband was a member of the Sanhedrin and was in on the plot, or at least had knowledge of the plot, and that's how their son knows about it, and he actually comes and tells Paul about it, and Paul makes sure that the message gets to the commander. The commander learns about this, and so the commander, because he now has in his custody a Roman citizen, and he's still acting pretty deferentially towards Paul, he arranges for Paul to be transported 65 miles up to Caesarea, which was the center of Roman government in that area. And this means that Paul now will stand before the governor himself, Felix. And if the Jews want to press any further charges against Paul, they'll have to go to Caesarea themselves and justify their charges before the governor, not just before the commander. And so that night, Paul is transported, that night and the next day, all the way up to Caesarea with a group of soldiers. Soldiers move back and forth in and out of Jerusalem regularly during this period of time, and so that wouldn't have seemed so unusual to the general public to see a group of 200 soldiers or more marching out of Jerusalem even at night, headed up towards Caesarea. And the commander uses this opportunity to have Paul transported up there and put in the custody of the governor himself. And that will bring us down to chapter 24, which we'll need to start next time. But what we see in all of this is that Paul is living out his convictions. As he said when he stood before the Sanhedrin, "I have acted in all good conscience." When he believed in the Jewish faith and believed Christians were wrong, he did everything in his power to stand for that. When he became convinced that Jesus really was alive from the dead and therefore must be the Messiah, and that the Christians were right, not wrong, then he did a 180 and did everything in his power to speak on behalf of that cause, even suffering a great deal over the last 25 years as he preached to others about this message. The book of Hebrews in chapter 11 has this great chapter of faith, where it reviews a lot of people from the Old Testament who, under great trials and suffering, stood up for what they believed in. Paul is of that kind. The writer in Hebrews chapter 11 reminds us that it's not what we suffer, it's how faithful we are that counts. Paul sometimes made a list of what all he had suffered, but he didn't make that list to make people feel sorry for him, but rather just to say, "This is how strongly I believe." Let's pray that we will have that kind of faith. So far, nothing has been presented in these trials of Paul that in any way refutes the truth of the gospel. That's a very interesting thing. Perhaps that's part of the reason Luke writes this and records it for us, is that while the Jews now have another opportunity to refute the truth of the gospel, no such refutations come forward. There's no arguments made about Jesus is still dead and we still have his tomb here and we know he's in there. There's no refutation of saying, well, all these people who claim they saw him alive have now confessed that they were lying about it. None of that has taken place, even 25 years later. And certainly Paul himself never backs down from what he believes is the truth. We need to have that same kind of faith in what we believe about the most fundamental aspects of the gospel. Jesus died for our sins and was raised from the dead and is now in heaven awaiting his return. We live that. Let's hope we'll die that.